Today we discuss five geopolitical challenges that can affect all Americans in 2023. This is Brief Before Impact. Welcome everyone, I am Matt Parker. Hope you all had a wonderful holiday season. Hopefully spending it with family and friends, and Happy New Year's to everyone. As I am recording today on January 1st, 2023. We're bringing in the new year as best as we can. Today's episode is going to cover five geopolitical issues that I believe will affect all Americans to some capacity in 2023. Here, let me list these out for you. And these are in no particular order of precedence of importance or anything like that. Number one is the adversarial challenge of China, and we'll focus specifically as well as on China and Taiwan. Second, obviously, Russia-Ukraine conflict, and more importantly, how that will actually affect European stability moving forward. Third, we're going to discuss border security and focus on drugs via South America and the issue of migration, immigration, etc. Fourth, we're going to discuss cybersecurity and artificial intelligence, how the threats of both being combined can challenge our national infrastructure here in the United States. And lastly, an issue that doesn't pop up too often on geopolitical challenges, but that would be the issue of human trafficking. So we'll get onto all those. Let me just take a quick ad break and then we will get to work. Hey, welcome back everyone. So let's start with China. I'll be brief, as I've done many episodes and talked in depth about the issues that America faces when dealing with China in a whole host of capacities. I'm just going to highlight, and broadly speaking, some of the overall economic issues and competition issues that the United States will face in 2023 when discussing China. And this is a report, according to Ernst & Young, 2023 Geostrategic Outlook, in relations among the great powers. So think about United States, China, etc. These relations have evolved from a system of overlapping collaboration and cooperation into a more bipolar configuration in which the United States and the European Union economies are disengaging from China and vice versa. In 2023, Washington and Brussels will likely continue to impose new restrictive policies explicitly or implicitly targeted at China. And Beijing will likely continue to shift domestic and foreign policies to become less intertwined with Western value chains. The result is likely to be a steady erosion of economic connectivity. Amid bipartisan support, Washington is likely to continue to introduce new export controls and investment limitations aimed at reducing the U.S.'s economy reliance on China for critical products and limiting China's access to strategic technologies. Implementation of existing laws will also impose new restrictions on bilateral trade investment. The European Union and its member states will likely also continue to impose greater restrictions on investment from China in critical industries. And Brussels is expected to use various policies in its trade defense toolbox, including addressing state subsidies, market access, and environmental issues to create what it views as a more even playing field for European companies vis-a-vis their Chinese competitors. Beijing is likely to expand industrial policies to accelerate efforts to become self-reliant in strategic technologies, prioritizing semiconductors. China will also likely seek to expand international economic relationships that do not rely on U.S. dollar and may promote rising capital in domestic markets. So one of the biggest takeaways we will see from this shift in economic alliances is essentially a supply chain reorientation. So as I've mentioned in previous episodes, the United States is currently, and most likely in the next 18 to 24 months, continue to promote legislation that will reshore American manufacturing, particularly of strategic goods, back to the United States. So about a year or two ago, we passed the CHIPS Act, which essentially begins funding semiconductor production here in the United States. And I believe from the research I've conducted on what kind of legislation we will now see in this kind of split Congress in Washington, D.C., in the next 2 years, most likely will be something of enhancing our industrial capacity and, again, bringing manufacturing back to the United States, particularly, though, of those more strategic goods. Think about semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, etc. Now, obviously, China is going to be doing the same, which is why Taiwan is such a particular focus for them. I've done a number of episodes, no need to rehash that issue, but as this kind of reorientation of supply chains and decoupling of economies continues in the future, I believe it raises the chances for conflict between China and Taiwan, and inevitably that region, and only brings us to a higher level. So that is the issue that I believe Americans will be seeing and facing in 2023 between the United States and China. So let's move on to our second topic, which is Ukraine. I'm not going to highlight the battle order movements or any of the actual military updates on the battlefield. This is more of a holistic approach to how that conflict is going to continue to affect European stability and, more importantly, global economies. Again, this is according to Ernst & Young 2023 Geostrategic Outlook. The war in Ukraine initiated the most significant shift in geopolitical relations since the end of Cold War. In 2023, uncertainty around the war and its consequences will remain very high, with significant regional and global political arid economic impacts. So Russia's President Putin is unlikely to de-escalate the war in Ukraine until he can claim some form of victory. Now, at the same time, the Ukrainian army will continue to defend Ukrainian territory, especially if it continues to receive the same levels of financial and material support from the United States and the European Union. The risk that this becomes a war of attrition will increase the longer it continues. If the conflict drags on, Putin could come under pressure domestically, as he is unlikely to step down voluntarily. Any sort of regime change would likely be disorderly and could even increase the risk of escalation if hardliners prevail. The risk of NATO members getting drawn into the conflict could increase if Putin comes under intense pressure and escalates the conflict. Every significant escalation in the war would likely lead to an additional developed market sanctions on Russia, which would also raise the impact of sanctioning countries' economies. In this scenario, the risk of disengagement between the U.S. and the European Union on the speed and nature of sanctions could rise. China, India, and others positioning on the war will also play a key role in shaping the evolution of the geopolitical environment. So one of the greatest takeaways of this conflict is that indeed more sanctions will most likely arrive, impacting businesses, which will lead to supply disruptions and higher prices. What has been fascinating to watch is, as we've dealt with domestically, a tremendous amount of inflation. The conflict in Eastern Europe has actually led to very high prices, particularly of fertilizer and wheat in continents of like Africa, for example, and the Middle East as well, that depends so much on Ukrainian wheat and Russian fertilizer. This is just one of those issues that we've seen as this war of attrition could continue on for how long, we're not entirely sure. Ultimately, this, I think, will continue to affect Americans as being, one, drawing attention away from our own domestic legislation that American citizens might be more interested in than sending billions over to Ukraine. I'm not debating whether we should be funding Ukraine or not, but it's more like our attention is focused there now compared to, say, something more germane to just your average everyday American citizen. And sadly, as the war continues on and those poor, more developing countries in Africa and the Middle East that depend so much on the commodities from Eastern Europe and Russia, as those continue to wane, we'll most likely see regional instability in certain countries unable to provide the basic necessities for their citizens that they've long depended on from those countries, like Ukraine and Russia. This could trickle over to affecting American business interests abroad. So that's how I see Ukraine and the conflict there affecting Americans in 2023. So moving to our third challenge is the issue of cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and I'm actually including drones in this topic. This isn't what I would call kinetic warfare, right? This isn't us American soldiers shooting guns at an enemy soldier. However, cybersecurity and cyber warfare is happening all the time. And though the loss of life doesn't exist, the loss of assets and control and stability, that is constantly taking place. And I find it fascinating that, and you've heard me talk about this before, the issue of cybersecurity and the next big conflict, I'm like a conflict on a global scale. I believe that cybersecurity is going to play a tremendous role in such a conflict, especially in the initiation of that conflict. So let me outline how the issue of cybersecurity, and particularly how drones will be used or can be used in order to diminish our own national infrastructure in protecting our digital and physical security. And this is according to Tripwire, discussing the state of security and how drones need to be addressed from a security threat. The unmanned aerial systems, or the UAS industry, has become a massive technological playground worldwide. There are extensive applications make UAS very popular for the public and for the private sector. Armed forces, agricultural industry, law enforcement, meteorological agencies, medical services, environmental companies, and oil refineries are but a few out of the excessive list of UAS users. UAS manufacturers spend a significant amount of money to research and development high-tech and smart systems, from aircraft-sized military UAS to hand-sized mini drones. Now, a part of the airworthiness and flight safety issues, drones affect the cyber domain and the security of data. Forbes points out that the malicious use of these platforms in the cyber domain is an inevitable fact, and it can no longer be pushed aside. Last Christmas, we witnessed the U.S. government posing export restrictions to one of the largest drone manufacturers in order to protect national security and foreign policy interest. Since drones are remotely controlled, they can be hijacked by bad actors. The Department of Homeland Security stated, quote, "Given their rapid technology advancement and proliferation, the public safety and homeland security communities must address the fact that drones can be used nefariously or maliciously to hurt people, disrupt activities, and damage infrastructure," end quote. So there are major cyber domain threats used by drone activity, and they are the following. I'll just highlight three for you. GPS spoofing. So what that is it's a way to take control of a drone. So attackers feed drones with false GPS coordinates and take full control of the platform. Now, security researchers have demonstrated how a hijacked drone can be used to hijack other drones, ending in a drone swarm under the control of cyber criminals. So it's easy to realize that in such a case, the threat potential increases drastically and can be compared to the way like a botnet performs like a denial of service attacks that we're kind of more familiar with, just like computers versus computers. This could be a way of taking over a significant amount of systems and the Internet of Thing devices. Especially as our world becomes more connected, your refrigerator to your air conditioning to your computer or your phone, these are a part of that Internet of Things, and the vulnerability that they are that they're presented by, and how drones can be used to defeat such Internet of Thing capabilities is going to only continue to increase as this technology advances. Secondly, an issue would be downlink intercept. So what this is, allows a criminal accessing all transmitted data between the drone and the controller. So since the majority of commercial drone systems interact with their base using unencrypted communication channels, they can become vulnerable to exploitation by a cyber criminal who can intercept and have access to sensitive data drone exchanges with the base. That'd be like pictures or videos and flight paths. Lastly is data exploitation. So critical infrastructure, it's protected in the terms of digital and physical security. the use of drones can overcome physical security limitations and cybersecurity protections. For a mini computer mounted on a small drone can approach undetected sensitive areas and carry out nefarious operations. It can mimic a Wi-Fi network to steal data. It can hijack Bluetooth peripherals. They can perform key logging operations to steal sensitive passwords, as well as compromise access points, unsecured networks, and devices. So the list, it's extensive on how drones can present this new aspect of a physical security threat complemented by the cybersecurity domain. It's like there's this tremendous amount of overlap. Think about this. If you were, say, 60 years ago, designing like a key piece of infrastructure, maybe like a dam, for example, you're going to dam up a river to provide energy to a region in the United States. So you build this huge dam. And in terms of physical security, all you thought about was like a gate, some fencing, maybe a key logged door for only employees to get into. Pretty much the basics, right? Because your threat at the time, in your mind at least, was a physical threat of a person trying to, say, destroy a key piece of the technology allowing the dam to operate, or maybe someone driving a truck with a bomb into it in the worst case scenario, something along these lines. Then, now as your technology has progressed and you've started to incorporate more high-speed computer systems to operate the dam, now you've started to focus on, now we have to protect this data, we have to protect these operations, this technology, while never updating your physical security component. Today, imagine a drone operated by a cyber criminal wanting to, say, destroy the dam or take it offline in some type of, to exploit it for, say, hey, I'm going to take this dam offline for 10 hours until I get paid, $100 million. Almost as an extortion type of situation. And they take that dam offline by stealing data via a drone that they flew near the dam to hack into the computer system. I'm kind of creating this scenario on the fly, but that literally is something that could be possible, and the how threats from a physical security perspective and how our key infrastructure has to catch up to this new technology of drones, especially being able to incorporate these kind of cyber criminal activities like hacking and spoofing, etc. So that kind of concludes the third issue here that I want to talk about, how it could affect American citizens. Our data is extremely vulnerable, and we all depend on our online activity for so many things. So cybersecurity is going to be a huge component, and now the issue of drones, I think we'll continue to see more and more of focus and attention on that issue. So fourth, and I'm going to spend a little more time on this one, is border security. Now, this is obviously unique. I'm focusing specifically on American citizens for obvious reasons, because Americans are overwhelming the people who listen to my podcast. So as a broad topic of what border security is, I'm focused here mostly on the southern border, since that's where, if you've been watching the news, or we've seen an incredible amount of influx of people coming across, and it seems that is record levels compared to in the past. What I want to focus on, though, is some of the rules that have been, like legislative rules and executive orders that have been changing, as well as the issue of illegal drugs coming across the border. And lastly, why there is so much migration right now. And I'll try to be concise and brief here. Just to highlight a piece just from Fox News reporting from Supreme Court ruled to maintain Title 42. What is that? It's a Trump-era policy, and it allows immigration officials to quickly expel migrants for public health due to coronavirus pandemic. So it basically says that the Border Patrol can expel people because they're worried about them having COVID or not. So many Twitter users praise this ruling, suggesting it's critical to ensure America's borders are properly enforced. Matter of fact, Utah Senator Mike Lee tweeted, "As required by today's Supreme Court order, the Title 42 public health order will remain in effect, and individuals who attempt to enter the United States unlawfully will continue to be expelled to Mexico or their home country. People should not listen to their lives of smugglers who take advantage of vulnerable migrants, putting lives at risk. The border is not open, and we will continue to fully enforce our immigration laws." So this gives Border Patrol more capabilities to prevent a tremendous amount of influx of people coming across the border. I want to just briefly highlight, because I talked about this in the past, of fentanyl and opioid crisis in the United States and how the border issue allows for this to take place. So I've talked about before, I'm not going to highlight again, the opioid crisis here in the United States, the issue of fentanyl as well. The demand for fentanyl and opioids, this is originated in three groups. I'm just going to highlight an article written by a congressional candidate in Utah, Nick Mitchell. So the first group was politicians who took lobbying money from pharmaceutical companies to help push legislation for opioids while suppressing any bills aimed at addressing the opioid epidemic they were in large part fueling. Also driven by the pursuit of wealth are the pharmaceutical companies who purposely suppress data of long-term effects in opioid use and the addictive nature of opioids they are producing. The third group responsible are the physicians who took money from those pharmaceutical companies to prescribe opioids. So, as you're probably aware of how opioids infiltrate the United States, how they've been abused by the individuals and citizens, how they're overprescribed, etc., the issue of border security is tied to that pandemic. We have a demand domestically for these opioids. And cartels in Latin America via sources from China will produce those opioids and illegally smuggle them through the border. So we have to address the opioid crisis in multiple facets, legislatively, focusing on the actual production of the goods, the prescription of those drugs, the pharmaceutical companies, etc. But we also have to deal with border security simultaneously. We have to walk and chew gum essentially at the same time, okay? And this is why when you look at the border policies by the Biden administration, it would appear that there's an indifference to the opioid pandemic and the issue of border security, because the incredible amount of influx of people coming across the border, that includes the illegal drugs coming with them. So I'll point out this research by Mark Morgan. He's a visiting fellow in the Border Security Center at the Heritage Foundation. And he writes that the Biden administration's open border policies have drawn 5 million illegal aliens from 160 different countries to our borders in just 18 months. The predictable result is a chaotic and deadly southern border where a complex set of threats are pouring into the United States. These situations become so dangerous and untenable that a judge in Kinney County, Texas, formally declared the county was being invaded. The crux of the crisis is not overly complicated. To deal with the crushing flow of illegal aliens, 80 to 90% of Border Patrol personnel are often pulled off the front lines to then go care for, process, and release those who have illegally crossed. Biden's Border Patrol has essentially been compelled to abandon much of its core mission to protect the American people. And this has left our borders wide open and facilitated the cartels broadening their operational control over our southern border, making it easier to them smuggle drugs in the United States and expand their human trafficking operation. So, for a minute here, think in your mind. The narrative and rhetoric coming from the Biden administration has compelled people in other parts of the world to illegally enter the United States via the southern border. They felt there was a better opportunity than there was in the past, therefore they showed up. Them showing up then compels our Border Patrol to move away from its typical operations of patrolling the border to personnel care of those illegal aliens crossing the border to process them and to care for them. So now you've got more people at the border having to be cared for by only a handful of Border Patrol agents, giving a better opportunity for people to illegally cross in the country. So this is just a circuitous routine. And though despite an increase of tremendous proportions of illegal people, aliens crossing the border, we haven't seen that equal increase of Border Patrol agents and resources at our southern border. So I'll close out with this question and try to address why, in fact, beyond just the rhetoric by the Biden administration, why is it that, what did I just list off, 160 different countries, people have 5 million illegal aliens have come across in the last 18 months? Why, in fact, and I'll focus just on Latin America, for example, why are these people coming in the first place? This is according to Paul Angelo, writing for Council on Foreign Relations. Economic precariousness, government corruption, crime, violence, and increasingly climate change are all driving migration from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The majority of Guatemalans and Hondurans live below the poverty line, and most people in the Northern Triangle are employed in the informal sector, which deprives them of social protections and insurance. The pandemic, which has disproportionately affected Latin America in public health and economic terms, has laid bare governance deficiencies across the region. Meanwhile, the erosion of democratic checks and balances by populist politicians and corrupt officials has left many Northern Triangle residents exasperated and disenfranchised. So the bottom line, people who live in countries that have weak governance, high crime, and lots of corruption tend to want to leave that country if for their future and the family, the future of their family, all they have to do is make it to the United States, which by outward appearances seems to be a great place to live, then they'll do that. They'll make that arduous journey north. So if I'm putting myself in their shoes, of course I get it. I totally understand why they would make the effort to come across the country. Complement that with the Biden administration's rhetoric and narrative about the border and their enforcement of the law being so lax and weak, it provides this perfect opportunity for people to cross the border. And when we kind of put the parallel between the open border situation and the opioid crisis and the influx of illegal drugs, it's just creating a chaotic scene that will have years of fallout. Even after Biden is out of office, it'll have years of fallout that politicians will have to address in true, meaningful ways. So this will, with that, I'll close out the border secure challenge, and we'll finish off with a little of a more difficult and harder topic to talk about, which is human trafficking. Typically, whenever reading about geopolitical challenges in 2023, you don't really come across human trafficking, and I think that's a terrible mistake. And I'll pick on climate change for a moment. Almost, if you research top geopolitical challenge of 2023, nearly everyone will say in those top three or four answers that climate change is one of those challenges. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. Here's my issue. Climate change is predicated on the issue that it'll affect millions or billions of people in the future, 20, 30, 100 years from now. Human trafficking is affecting millions of people, disproportionately women and children, today, right now, this very instance. And it's affecting them in ways that you can't describe over a podcast. It's so evil and dark in my mind. So I'll give you a little bit of the numbers and then how we can actually protect. I'm going to focus on protecting our kids from human trafficking. So the International Labor Organization, they released this global estimate on modern slavery, and this is back in 2017. So they're looking at numbers from 2016. Probably those numbers have, you know, moved up or down, but more or less this is giving an idea. So at 2016, at any given time, there was approximately 24.9 million people in forced labor. So that's about 25 million folks across the world in some type of slavery. Let's tease out what that actually looks like. This is according to Deliver Fund, which, by the way, is a nonprofit ran by former CIA and Navy SEALs who are trying to eliminate human traffickers here in the United States. Deliver Fund, I highly recommend you go look them up and support them. And they write that human trafficking, which is also modern-day slavery, is alive and well in the United States. Every year, millions of people in the world, including here in the U.S., are bought and sold for the purposes of forced labor or sexual exploitation. And it can happen to any demographic, any gender, any race or nationality. It is estimated that 15,000 to 50,000 women and children are forced into sex slavery in the United States every year. And that total number varies wildly because it's just difficult to research. The Department of Health and Human Services estimate about 240,000 to 325,000, while the University of Pennsylvania puts it more at 100,000 to 300,000. The point being, it's a lot of people, which is hard to really nail it down. There are many ways in which women and children are trafficked. And by the way, males are indeed trafficked and sometimes used in sex trafficking, but it's more like for trafficked in labor markets, okay? So some of the ways females are trafficked include pimp control trafficking, so in which a single person controls the victim physically, psychologically, or emotionally. Gang trafficking, in which a victim is controlled by more than one person and may be abused by the gang members or prostituted out by the gang. Survival sex, where the victim feels they are not able to escape and perform sex acts in order to survive. Familial trafficking, in which the victim is abused and controlled by their family members and forced marriages. So sex trafficking has grown exponentially since the dominance of the internet and the online porn industry. Victims are either used in pornographic pictures or videos, or they are prostituted out through online platforms such as Craigslist, Facebook, Mako Space. Some dedicated websites are created through subscription services. There's a San Diego adult service provider, for example, and they charge members $100 a month to browse its online catalog and purchase sex. That site was taken down by police in 2016. The most common area of labor trafficking, though, it's actually in agriculture, so that would encompass both legal and undocumented workers. The exploitation is often threats of violence, either to a worker or their loved ones, the threat of deportation, or even perpetual debt that the worker owes to their crew leader. It's important to note that while some of the trafficking, it's on a small level, so like just one crew leader, you know, threatening a couple of workers, it also takes place on a large corporate scale. Example, in 2000, there was a labor contractor, JB Farm Labor. They forced hundreds of workers to farm asparagus for little to no pay. Those workers, mostly from Mexico, were charged large fees that were deducted from their paychecks, leaving them trapped and enslaved. So when people talk about like slavery has been over for 150 years in the United States, no, not quite. It is still ongoing, and it is in both just forced labor markets and then more evil and terrible ways of sex trafficking. So I want to conclude this topic, though, on how to protect our children. We can discuss on how we should address, you know, the porn industry or adults being trafficked, but for all intents and purposes, since now so many children have access to the internet, I thought it'd be important to highlight how can we actually protect our kids. So being vigilant about online safety is the most important task that we have as parents, I think. And again, this is according to just Children's Mercy, writing about how we can do this. Traffickers, they're on every popular app that kids love. So we need to know exactly what our kids are doing online. Got to give them guidelines of what types of information are okay and not okay to post. Who they can chat with, like known friends only. Who to block. And we should make sure that our kids turn off location services when posting on social media. Make sure, like, when they take a photo, it doesn't show like they're at the local park in your local neighborhood. You know, that just gives groomers an idea of like where your kids hang out, right? Additionally, don't post photos that show what school they go to or what neighborhood you live in. Don't post photos with kids in their swimwear, underwear, or even in the bathtub. Yeah, I know that's kind of cute for like little kids. Just do not do that. Also, consider whether to use their name online and to make sure social media accounts are private. So, to recognize some signs that trafficking may be occurred with your kid, just think for example, you've got maybe an 11 to 14-year-old daughter. I'm just giving a hypothetical. If you notice some of these things, it could be a sign of some trafficking. Not always by any means, but it's something to be aware of. So, for example, some signs like they're withdrawing from you. Maybe some new onset of anxiety or depression, self-harm, eating disorders, maybe a sudden change in their grades or engagement at school, a new friend group or a controlling romantic relationship, new expensive gifts or unexplained sums of money, unexplained aches and pains, or lastly, sexually transmitted infections. So this is by no means holistic, but I just wanted to keep in mind, like, when you're thinking about your kids, lean on the side of being the uncool parent who doesn't let their kid do stuff online. I'd rather be that parent and my kids gripe about me than, God forbid, some groomer out there finds a photo of my child and tries to begin luring them into some trafficking situation. So I know any parent can certainly empathize and put themselves in those shoes. So consider that. So that's it for these five issues, geopolitical challenges, that I believe all Americans will somehow be affected by in 2023. It'll be a fascinating year, particularly as we continue to move away from like the COVID world that we all inhabited for 2 years, and that we kind of find some way of normalcy here in the United States, dealing with still inflation, an inevitable recession on its way, and so forth. Multiple challenges to think about. Hopefully you found this useful. I'll dive into each of those challenges over the course of this year, on and off, and they will inevitably be tied together. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and again, Happy New Year to everyone. I hope 2023 is a blessing for you and your family, and as always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.